You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Hey, San Francisco, we want to get back to our city by the bay. So we are this January.
That's right, man. We're going back to Sketchfest. It's become an annual deal for us there at the Castro Theater. Always some of the best audiences of the year. You are our peeps, and we love coming to see you. So get your tickets to see us at the Castro. What day are we there?
We're going to be there Saturday, January 18th.
That's right, for a primetime show.
Yep, so go to sysklive.com and follow the links to get information and tickets. We'll see you guys in January.
Welcome to Stuff You Should Know, a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh Clark. There's Charles W. Chuck Bryan over there. There's Jerry right there just laughing it up.
Yeah.
And this is Stuff You Should Know. The Jokester Jerry edition.
Dense Science edition, a.k.a. Chuck Die Slowly Inside edition.
Dude, no, it's not. You're going to do just fine. This is all so intuitive. It's wonderful.
I'm not worried about not doing fine. But thanks for the reassurance.
Sure. Well, then I'm really excited about this if you know that.
I think you're going to do fine.
You are going to as well. I'm going to see to it.
I think Jerry's going to do great.
Jerry, how are you doing over there? Okay.
She's pressing buttons like I've never seen her press buttons.
Stop doing that. I wonder what kind of weird sound effects just happened after touching all those buttons. Jerry just laughed. I don't know if the mic picked that up. All right, everybody's like, okay, you're officially stalling now.
Jerry's a quiet laugher, though. You ever notice that?
It's all nose.
Yeah, she's all nose.
This is Jerry laughing hard.
There's some...
She's doing it right now.
Serious ASMR triggering going on right
now.
Yeah,
that's right. And there's a little bit of snot on the microphone cover.
All right. Carbon 14 dating. It works, sort of. The end.
It's not the worst description of it ever.
Yeah.
We can do better than that, though.
Yes. And luckily, you did a great job with this, but I also, you know, my advice to anyone, if you don't understand a science thing and you're an adult, just don't worry about what anyone behind you thinks. Just looking at your laptop, and right. You go to the most rudimentary children's science website you can find.
Yeah.
And that always helps.
There is no shame in that.
No shame.
Because seriously, the people who write those websites are probably some of the best science explainers on the planet.
Yeah. And they know how to really just not dumb it down because kids are smart. But,
right. You know. That's funny. You flip-flopped on kids, apparently.
You mean stupid kids?
Yeah. You always said they were dumb until just now. So good for you, Chuck.
We're all over the map.
Well, I feel like we're really growing up these days. Mm-hmm. So carbon-14, for those of you who don't know, is this really clever scientific method where you can actually kind of look inside of a material and figure out how much carbon-14 is in there. And by doing so, you can actually tell how old it is, or at least how long ago it was since the thing you're dating was alive.
Yes, and it is a comparative – well, there's another word for that. What's it called?
Relative dating?
Yeah, relative dating. Mm-hmm. I guess comparative isn't the worst word.
Right, especially if you're talking about literature.
Right, because what they're doing is comparing it to things that are alive today, and because of all the gobbledygook we're about to talk about, that equals a pretty good estimate. And then from there, there are even further things that one can do if one were so inclined as a scientist.
And there are a lot of people who are inclined to do this. This is a very exciting, energetic field of science right now. Like if you want to, if you want to jump into an ever evolving, constantly moving BA field,
BA Baracus field,
kind of science, start studying radiocarbon dating.
Yeah, actually, it wouldn't be a BA Baracus field because didn't that stand for bad attitude?
Did it?
I think so, right?
Oh, no one in radiocarbon dating has a bad attitude.
No, but they are BAs.
Right.
Exactly. But you're right. It is ever evolving, and they're constantly looking for better ways to pinpoint more accurate timelines on things.
Right.
So it's not like a job you're going to get in and be like, oh, this old thing again.
Right. No, no. And it's just like they're constantly filling in blanks and stuff like that. It's good work.
It is.
So what they're looking for, the people who do radiocarbon dating, is carbon-14, which I said, and that is radiocarbon. It's called that because it's a radioactive form of carbon.
That's right.
And it's everywhere on Earth. It's just all over the place. It's part of the carbon cycle, and it's part of the web of life. But it starts out way up in outer space as a cosmic ray.
That's right. Should we give the basis definition before we jump to the ins and outs?
Of radiocarbon dating?
Yeah.
Sure, yeah, sure.
I mean, I think like the most rudimentary definition might help some people out. But like you said, carbon-14 is everywhere, including inside us, because it's in plants via photosynthesis.
Yeah.
And we eat plants.
Yeah.
And animals eat plants.
Yeah.
Some people eat animals.
Sure.
And because of that, it's kind of in every living thing.
Right.
And carbon-14 dies away very slowly.
Mm-hmm.
And because we know this and because we know it happens predictably,
right,
then we can measure that in a sample and then compare it, like I said, to something living.
Mm-hmm.
And then you do a little math, ipso facto.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably an ipso facto, is it? Presto change-o?
Yeah, presto change-o.
Bada bing, bada bing, Bon Jovi? What was that?
Bada bing, bada boom, Bon Jovi. Yeah, that was yours.
Was it?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
You came up with that on a carousel at Zoo Atlanta in about 2012.
That's right. That's where that's carbon dated to.
Yeah.
That joke.
Yeah.
But because we know that, we can compare it to something that's alive today. And then with a little math, we can figure out a rough estimate of how old it is.
Yeah. That's radiocarbon dating in a nutshell for sure.
That's right. But like you said, it starts out as cosmic rays way out in outer space.
Right. And so a cosmic ray, we're not entirely certain where they come from, but they're super high energy particles, usually like pieces of atoms that are just shooting toward Earth and through outer space at incredible speeds.
Yeah.
And when they encounter the atmosphere, they start running into the atoms that make up the atmosphere. And because these particles are so high energy, these cosmic rays, when they smack into atoms and other particles and molecules and all that, they just burst them apart.
Yeah.
Not just burst like an atom into like its protons and neutrons. It'll tear apart a neutron like it's nothing. Actually creates other high energy particles like muons, pions, X-rays. what else?
Zaxxons.
Is that right?
No, that was a video game.
Was it?
Zaxxon?
Yeah.
Sure. It was a good one.
With a Z?
Yeah, I think it was ZAXXON, if I'm not mistaken.
I am not familiar with that.
It was an Atari.
Oh, okay. It wasn't a stand-up game?
Oh, actually, it may have been, but I played it on Atari.
Because I could see a kid in a KISS t-shirt playing that game stand-up in an arcade.
Yes.
It sounds like that kind of game.
That would have been me had I not been deathly afraid of KISS.
I'll bet.
Because they were devil...
Well,
Double
they
rock.
Were knights in Satan's service, obviously.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay, so all these muons, X-rays, pions, all that stuff. There's one other little particle that can be created when a cosmic ray collides with an atom, and that is a neutron, a high-energy neutron, right?
That's right.
Okay, so what's happening now is a chain reaction because cosmic rays are bombarding the atmosphere.
That's right, and what can happen is they can get really pushy. If a high-energy neutron collides with, let's say, a nitrogen-14 atom,
yeah,
they'll get real pushy and they'll just knock the proton off and move right in there and say, this is my house now.
Right. So what was once a stable atom, nitrogen-14, which had 7 protons and 7 neutrons.
7 each.
Is now an unstable atom with 6 protons and 8 neutrons. And now it's no longer nitrogen-14. What you have, fella... is carbon-14.
Yes, and unstable meaning radioactive, but not radioactive meaning like scary and dangerous.
No, it just means that it's in a higher energy state and it's temporary. It eventually wants to decay back into that nitrogen 14 state.
And yes, eventually, and it does that.
Yeah, eventually, it's sometimes spontaneously, sometime down the road, that neutron will turn back into a proton, which sounds like magic until you realize that atoms and all of the particles that make up atoms are really just vibrations of energy, and it can temporarily go to a higher energy state or a lower energy state, and that is how something would change from like a high energy neutron back to a proton.
Right. And you said that carbon 14 is everywhere, which is true, but that doesn't mean there's like tons and tons of it relative to carbon 14, or wait, carbon 12.
Yeah, it's,
there's a lot more carbon 12.
Right. So carbon 12 is the stable version of carbon.
Yeah.
And it's way more abundant than carbon 14. Carbon 14 is kind of like a freak, a monster that gets made accidentally.
That's right.
And is extremely rare, even though there's a ton of it. But compared to carbon 12, it's very rare. Something like one carbon 14 atom for every trillion carbon atoms.
That's right.
That's pretty rare. But it also gives us a ratio, Chuck, and this is a big initial point.
Yeah, and like you mentioned before, too, or maybe I said it, it's this is part of the carbon cycle. So it's inside all the plants, and the animals are eating the plants. We're eating plants.
All right.
Some people eat animals.
Yeah.
So it's inside all of us, and it's everywhere. But that ratio is really important because, like we said, it starts to decrease because it craves homeostasis and wants to get back to its former life as a stable particle.
Right. Or as a stable boy.
Stable boy? Yeah. Brush that horse.
And it would be an atom because it's going from a carbon 14 atom to a nitrogen 14 atom.
Right, but that ratio is important because as it, you know, dies away, there're going to be fewer and fewer carbon 14 atoms with that dead organism over time, whereas if something is alive, it has that steady amount, and that's where the comparison comes in.
Right. Because as far as a plant or you or a dog or anything living is concerned, there's no difference whatsoever between a carbon 14 molecule of carbon dioxide and a carbon 12 molecule of carbon dioxide.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds hard to digest because we said it's radioactive, but there really is no difference as far as we're concerned.
Right. It basically takes a human scientist to analyze it using an extremely sophisticated machine to be able to tell the difference.
That's right.
So that means that when it does, you know, come down out of the atmosphere, it's spewed out by a volcano or something like that, it just becomes part of the food chain like any other atom of carbon.
Sure.
That's locked in with oxygen to form carbon dioxide. So as you're living, like you were saying, you're constantly taking it in. You're constantly eating. It's just a part of life as carbon 14 and carbon 12, right?
Yeah.
But when you die, you stop taking in carbon of all kinds. And all of a sudden, a clock is set because of that decay of carbon 14.
That's right.
And that decay, like we said, it happens spontaneously. An atom might suddenly convert from carbon 14 to nitrogen 14. You can't predict when that's going to happen because of the uncertainty that's part of quantum physics, right? But if you have a large enough sample, then you can start to predict when X number or X percentage of that sample of carbon-14 will have spontaneously changed from carbon-14 to nitrogen 14, and that's called the half-life, that which is everyone has heard of. That's half-life. That's just standard stuff.
Yeah, I think everyone has heard of half-life, and I bet 90% of the people that know that term don't really fully grasp it.
Well, yeah, it's just this the amount of time it takes for half of the radioactive atoms in any given sample to convert back into a stable form.
Yeah.
That's it.
It's pretty easy. And we know in this case the half-life, and we'll get to how we figured all this out, but the half-life of carbon-14 is 5,730 years.
Mm-hmm.
If, you know, you keep going, it goes to a quarter life, then I guess an eighth?
Yeah, it just keeps going. So like if you have 100 carbon-14 atoms, if you come visit it in 5,730 years, you're going to find you have 50. And if you visit in another 5,730 years, you're going to have 25.
Right.
And then 12 and a half or 13, maybe. I don't know. And it just keeps going until there's ultimately none left over a long enough stretch of time, which is with carbon 14, like 50 or 60,000 years.
Yeah, I saw 60,000 mostly, mm-hmm. but then I think it can get a little hinky at 50.
Yeah.
So 50 to 60 is pretty good.
And I think it gets hinky at this point because of the equipment we're using to measure it.
Oh, really?
I think as our equipment gets more and more sensitive, mm-hmm. that time will go further and further out. Because as long as you have two atoms, you should still be able to measure them, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
Or even one, probably. I'm not going to go out on on a limb for that one, but
someone will let us
I'm going to caveat that with the probably.
Okay. Well, let's take a little break here, and we're going to come back here in a second, talk about the very smart dude who figured all this stuff out quite a few years ago.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Refinancing your car at Kemba Financial Credit Union can get you quick access to cash to help manage high-rate debts and expenses. Get up to $500 next day cash back, plus no payments for 90 days, and take cash equity out. Make your car work for you and drive away with extra cash. Apply at Kemba.org. Restrictions apply. Offer ends April 30th, 2024. Federally insured by NCUA.
All right, Chuck, just to recap real quick, because I think this episode bears it, okay?
Okay.
You've got carbon 14. It's mm-hmm. part of the food chain. You take it in as you're living. When you die, you stop taking it in. And so those carbon 14 atoms start to decay, which means that if you compared a dead organism to a living organism and the ratio of carbon 14 to carbon 12 in the dead organism compared to the living organism, mm-hmm. you'd be able to tell how long ago the dead organism was alive and taking in more carbon. And that's the basis of radiocarbon dating.
That's right. So that is, we have a man to thank from the University of Chicago mm-hmm. named Willard Libby.
That's a great name. I heard his name was Wild Man or Wild Bill.
Wild Man Willard Libby?
Yeah.
Because he's just crazy?
I guess. He must have been a party animal.
Who knows?
You don't get a nickname like Wild Bill.
No, no.
For nothing. They don't go around handing those out to just anybody.
Yeah, not even just figuring out carbon 14 dating. You wouldn't get a Wild Man for that.
No, no, no. Like even Chris Farley wasn't called Wild Bill.
No. I think Willard Libby had a side gig.
Yeah.
You know?
But he was the party monster.
Maybe at the University of Chicago in the 1940s, mm-hmm. perhaps.
Yeah.
So he figured out how carbon 14 worked and how it could be used to do this before we were even positive, science even knew for a fact mm-hmm. that there was such a thing as carbon 14.
That's pretty impressive.
And in fact, in 1946, it was just a few short years after we had discovered cosmic rays. So he was really on the leading edge of science.
Yeah.
You know, he was a wild man.
Yeah, right. He's like, these particles, we're not even sure they exist, but if they do, we could figure out how to use them to date dead organisms.
And he won a Nobel Prize in 1960 for this.
I think rightfully so.
In chemistry, yeah, for sure. Even though, as we'll see, he got a few things wrong.
Well, yeah.
And the one thing that's kind of tough to wrap your head around here is he, and this is, it just is what it is at this point, I think, but he selected 1950.
Right.
The year 1950 is year zero.
Right.
For his experimentation. Mm-hmm. And he compared all the samples against this, and that is still what we do today.
Right.
That we didn't revise a lot of this stuff. It's
no.
interesting.
No, like they definitely are like, okay, I think the reason why is because by the time it started to become sophisticated and more refined, so many samples had gone through that it's like, we're just going to stick with this for now. Okay.
1950.
Yeah.
It's really interesting.
So 1950, when you're radiocarbon dating an object, that is year zero.
Yep.
So anytime you get a date back, which we'll talk about, it's actually saying this is how long before 1950 this thing was last alive.
Right. And we're not talking, it doesn't have to be like a plant fossil. Because we said carbon is in, you know, virtually everything.
Right.
So a leather belt comes from a cow.
Yeah.
That cow ate the plant.
Yeah.
What and else? Wooden ships.
Ate a pig.
Fabric.
Yeah.
Poop. You find poop, of course, old poop, old alcohol, old beer.
Yeah.
Because of yeast.
Right.
There are many, many, many things. Obviously bodies, Otzi.
Yeah.
Our pal.
Yeah. As long as whatever you are dating was at one point alive, which means it wasn't a rock,
right,
or a mineral from birth. You can date it. You should be able to date it as long as it's about 50 or 60,000 years or younger.
Yeah, but there was a problem early on in this process because you needed a lot of this material
to basically
destroy to find out how old it is.
Mm-hmm.
And people didn't want to give up these great finds. Like, I found a skull.
Right.
And they're like, well, can we destroy that skull to find out how old it is? And, you know, they would turn around and say, no, it's my skull.
Right, right. And then the radiocarbon researcher was saying, like, I was just asking to be pleasant. Give me that skull.
Yeah, but then you would say, no, it's my skull, and I'm just happy to call it old.
Right. And then Willard Libby would step in and just do like
the wild man.
A pile driver on the guy with the
That's
skull.
That's why he got the name.
Yep.
He would just come in and crush people.
Yeah. He'd be hiding maybe in another room in back or something and just pounce.
And someone would go, caw-caw.
Yeah. And he would swarm.
But here's the thing. We've gotten a lot better over time. The equipment has gotten a lot better, more sophisticated. So we don't need that much now. And people are giving up their finds because you can have a little gram of bone from the skull.
Right.
And I think everything will be okay.
Yeah. And so because of that, like, it's gotten way more common to radiocarbon date stuff. I read in the UK, they really started dating everything they found because the UK passed a law that said if you're a developer and you turn up any sort of archaeological evidence mm-hmm. on, like, one of your buildings or developments, you have to pay to have it dated. And so, like, it started to kind of get the burden for paying for it was shifted to industry.
Oh, interesting.
And so it started to really blow up. And that helped kind of push the technology along and help lower the expense and increase the sophistication of the machines that were being used.
Wow.
Yeah. Pretty neat how that happens.
Well, here's what you got to do if you're going to start out this process is you got to really clean your sample very well.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it's going to it can mess up everything and not just the test that you're making. If you have what's called a hot sample, which means you didn't clean it well enough or it's contaminated.
A gram of hot sample.
You can destroy a lab basically to the point where they'll just have to shut down for weeks or even months
right.
to get everything right. And everything in there might be destroyed.
Like, yeah.
All the other samples that may be super valuable.
Mm-hmm. My skull.
Yeah.
You know?
Sorry.
So it's a big deal if something isn't cleaned right because it really throws everything off and can ruin everything else. But once you do have it cleaned, when you date it, there's a few different methods that you can use. But the one that I saw is the most common is actually turning that carbon-based sample into carbon graphite, like pure carbon. And then you take that little piece of pure carbon that you've just created and you shoot a beam of energy through it.
A lot of energy.
Yeah.
Like 2 million volts.
Yeah, which is a lot.
Just not all at once. I think they ramp it up, don't they?
Yeah, over time. But at some point, it's been accelerated to 2 million volts of energy.
Right.
Okay, and then so once you have this thing, basically a mini particle accelerator, it's passed through a spectrometer, which can actually measure the different masses of the atoms in this beam that you've shot through the graphite.
That's right. It's detecting the little bits of carbon.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the level of technology we're at right now in 2019, and this has been around since like the 80s or 90s.
Yeah.
Just think of what's coming next.
What did they use before the spectrometer?
They used
like
something called
50 and 80.
Beta counting. And it was clunky and expensive and not nearly as reliable.
Yeah.
But basically what it did was something different where it would sit there and study a piece of graphite or gas. They often gasify stuff too, mm-hmm. pure gas. And then it would just like shoot a beam through it and study. I think a beam. It would somehow study the sample mm-hmm. for days, maybe, and it would count the number of atoms that had spontaneously converted from carbon 14 to carbon 12.
Wow!
And then it would do a little mathematic rigmarole and say, "This is how at this rate of decay, this is how old this organism is."
Well, thank goodness we have the spectrometer now. Then,
yeah,
because it's much more precise
and it sounds
and faster.
It sounds more futuristic too.
Yeah, mass spectrometers.
Yeah.
So you're going to shoot this beam. You're going to throw it in the Wonder Machine. Actually, not the Wonder Machine. We've already taken that for something else.
Yep, it's a thoughtless piece of graphite.
And then you compare that ratio to the, again, year zero, which is the ratio in 1950, mm-hmm. which is still a little confusing.
Yeah, it's clunky.
It is very clunky. And then that difference, basically, like we've said eight times now, mm-hmm. Shows how many years have passed to produce that amount of decay in that sample.
Right. So if you took like a sample of wood from an old ship, an old boat you found, route? That's the new route, by the way.
Did you say route?
Yeah.
Okay.
And you analyzed it and you found that based on the amount of carbon 14 in there, it was something like, it dated to like 845 BCE.
Okay.
Okay. You'd be like, great, now we know where this ship is from. But if you tried to go out and publish a study with that, hopefully your radiocarbon colleagues would be like, whoa, whoa, whoa.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a few more steps involved here.
You're new here.
And that's like the most precise radiocarbon date anyone would have ever given. You'll be laughed out of the field if you do this.
Yes, don't do that.
Instead, there's a couple of things that you have to do first. So radiocarbon dates are given as a span of time.
Sure, bit of a range.
Right. So it'll say, and also because it's comparing to 1950, it's given not as a date like BCE or AD or CE or anything like that. Mm-hmm. It's BP, before present, years before present.
That's right.
So for that piece of wood, say, you would actually get something like 2,715 years before present, plus or minus 30 years.
So is it always 30 or is it?
No, it can.
It can depend.
It can range dramatically.
Right.
Like Ötzi is, they have them down to about 300 or 350 years.
Okay.
And you, like the shorter the span of time, mm-hmm. the plus or minus years mm-hmm. or the window of years that you get, the less confidence you have. So maybe you'll have like 26% confidence that it's from, 845 BCE to 855 BCE.
Right.
But you have 95% confidence that there's like this 200-year span, it's somewhere in there.
That makes sense, because I have 1,000,000% confidence that it's somewhere within the last 18 million years.
Exactly. Exactly. Right? So
sure.
It just keeps, the larger the window, the more confident you are.
Yeah.
But I mean, still, you're talking 100, 200 years, depending on how old the sample is, how good the sample is.
Yes.
So it's still pretty, they can zero it in pretty well.
And that science's job is to not say, well, let's just make a really big range.
Right.
And that'll be good enough.
Right.
They want to zero in as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's, and still be accurate.
Right. So the thing is, though, is if you do the math and you say, well, wait a minute.
On your example?
Yeah.
Yeah.
2,715 years before present, plus or minus 30 years, gives you a range of between 726 and 666 BCE.
But that's not even close to what you said.
Yeah, which was 845 before, right?
That's right.
Yeah. So why wouldn't 845 be in the sample, Chuck?
Well, because like we said in the very first sentence, radiocarbon dating is not super accurate. I mean, it's accurate mm-hmm. on a wide range, but it's a little clunky.
It is. Part of it is because there's actual problems, like known problems built in
right.
to the actual process of radiocarbon dating and the results that they get back.
Should we take another break?
I'll bet that pause I just had sounded really long in the replay.
Probably so.
Felt like it. But yeah, let's take a break, man.
All right. We'll come right back and talk about more science right after this.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Refinancing your car at Kemba Financial Credit Union can get you quick access to cash to help manage high-rate debts and expenses. Get up to $500 next day cash back, plus no payments for 90 days, and take cash equity out. Make your car work for you and drive away with extra cash. Apply at Kemba.org. Restrictions apply. Offer ends April 30th, 2024. Federally insured by NCUA.
So, I thought this was this from How Stuff Works? And you in your brain?
And yeah, and a bunch of other places too, sure. Right.
And you in your brain?
Sure.
Okay. But there's an interesting thing to note here, which is science makes a lot of assumptions when it comes to dating stuff.
All right.
And this is the best way to say it. If you find, like, if they find, like, a leather shield that they dig out of a archaeological site, they get super excited, and they can date the shield, and they can say, or they probably will say, well, whoever this heroic person was in the battlefield died on this – around this date, because that's where the shield is dated from.
Right.
But that is not necessarily true, because they're dating the shield from the cow skin that's on the handle, let's say. And that just says when that cow was alive last.
Right.
Has nothing to do with when this person made the shield, how long that leather had been around before they went out onto the battlefield and took an arrow to the forehead.
Yeah, maybe they were like super into vintage leather to use on their shield handle.
Sure.
Yeah. It sounds ridiculous, but it's
old
totally
hipsters.
Possible.
Yeah.
But the thing is archaeology is based on making assumptions and presumptions based on the context.
Right.
And it's like, this is totally fine. This is widely accepted. This is not new or scandalous at all. But like, that is part of archaeology's job, is to say, here's the context of this find.
Right.
And based on this radiocarbon date of this, it's a pretty good guess that they killed the cow, made the leather, made the shield, and then the guy died probably within a 10-15 year window.
Sure. Unless, you know? I mean, the idea, it would be an even weirder assumption to think that it was an ancient hipster who collected old leathers.
Right. Check out my new.
That's right.
And then the other part of it too is they also use it to compare to other stuff. Like if they're in a pit filled with other soldiers of a certain, you know, from a certain nation or clan or whatever. And they knew of a lost grave. They may have found that if it kind of roughly correlates to the date they were thinking. Like, there's a lot of stuff that they put together. They don't just say, here's what the radiocarbon date says, so this is what it is.
That's right. So because science does this, Libby was certainly doing this. The wild man was doing this. And he was making assumptions. And he was – and, hey, we're not knocking the guy because he won a Nobel Prize for this.
Yeah.
But he assumed a couple of things that were not correct, one of which was he got the half-life wrong.
Yeah.
He said the half-life of carbon-14 was 5,568 years.
So close.
We actually know it's 5730, like we said.
Not that close.
And he also presumed that carbon-14 in the atmosphere is very steady over time, and it's something we can really depend on. Being like there being a certain amount.
Yeah, like,
and that's not really the case either.
No, it's not. And that second one's a big one. Like the first one, you can just mess around with some math and be like, oh, okay, well, this is the actual half-life.
Well, but it's interesting. That's what we've had to do, because that's another thing we didn't go back and change, because it was all done on the basis of 5568.
Right, right. So the initial stuff, the initial dates that were done when Libby invented it were based on a half-life of 5,568.
From 1950.
Right. I don't know exactly when they figured it out, but at some point in the ensuing decades, they figured out, no, the half-life is actually 5,730. And rather than just go back and analyze the old samples, which actually may have been destroyed by this time.
Right.
They said, we're just going to stick with this convention and follow it. And we could just do the math and just say, actually, this is the real half-life, convert it to the Libby half-life, and then have a radiocarbon date.
Yeah, but the other thing you got wrong, like you said, is the bigger problem, because it can't just be solved with math. And that is his presumption that carbon-14 in the upper atmosphere is produced at a steady rate. Mm-hmm. We know now that there are all kinds of things
right.
that can and have affected that rate over the years. Everything from ocean currents to supervolcanoes to mm-hmm. solar flares mm-hmm. to the Earth's magnetic field. Mm-hmm. It has fluctuated a lot over time.
Yeah. But I mean, from year to year,
yeah.
we're starting to find that it's not at all steady. And that's a big one because one of the foundations of radiocarbon dating is this idea that it's like a reliable clock that just starts clicking backwards,
right.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
At any point in time, whatever year you come in on, you're going to be able to compare it to a modern sample and get a coherent radiocarbon date that
right.
will make sense. That's just absolutely not the case because of all of those fluctuations.
Right.
That's something that this field is definitely grappling with, which it will be able to overcome and largely has already because they use other types of dating to calibrate their radiocarbon dates.
Yeah, which is really cool. We were talking about the relative dating of carbon-14 dating.
Mm-hmm.
What they're now trying to do, well, not now, they've been doing it for a while, is absolute dating, like what you're talking about, comparing it to known quantities. And one of those is tree rings.
Yeah.
And I'm surprised we've talked about tree rings a little bit here and there,
mm-hmm.
but I wonder if it could be a shorty on its own.
Sure.
At least.
Yeah.
Maybe more.
We'll just start rapping on it, and whether if it turns into a real deal episode, we'll go with
yeah,
it.
Yeah. We'll just cancel our dinner plans and just keep going. But tree ring dating is called dendrochronology, counting tree rings.
Mm-hmm.
And not all trees have tree rings. We'll get to that, which can be a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of them do, and some of them grow every year, just like you've learned, and everyone probably thinks is true from, like, kid science class.
Right.
It's like once a year a tree has a ring, so if you cut a tree down, you can just count the rings and know how old it is.
Which is, I mean, basically right, depending on the tree.
Exactly. But here's the thing is trees absorb that carbon-14 just like everything else,
mm-hmm.
but those tree rings don't. Once they have completed a tree ring cycle,
mm-hmm.
that tree ring is essentially dead inside the tree mm-hmm. and is not accepting any more carbon-14.
Yeah, it's like a fossil. It's like if you look at the outside of a tree, that's the living part. Like as big as a tree is and mm-hmm. enormous as it is, the actual living part of it is just this outside veneer and like the leaves and everything, right?
Yeah, I guess so.
Everything inside is what used to be outside but is now inside.
That's right.
Because a new ring of growth grew around it. So since it's not taking in any more carbon, it's like a snapshot
mm-hmm.
of the carbon-14 that was in the atmosphere the year that tree ring grew.
Yes, and we know this. And now we have something to compare against those carbon-14 data results.
Yeah, because if you chop the tree down today, you would say, thank you, Father Tree, Mother Tree, for sacrificing your life for science.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you have to say first.
Right.
And you start counting the tree rings backwards. If you get to another tree that's much older,
mm-hmm.
but that lived, the lifetime of which overlapped with the tree you just cut down,
yeah.
you can eventually jump over from the tree you just cut down to this older tree
yeah.
and keep counting backwards. And then just keep, if you find enough old trees, keep leaping from tree to tree, counting tree rings as if it was one big old tree.
That's really cool.
It is. And there are very, very old trees that do exist on Earth that you can count backwards from over very long spans of time. But you can also use multiple trees.
Yeah, and like, if you're sitting at home or in your car thinking, well, why don't they just find the oldest tree and go there?
Mm-hmm.
Like you want that overlap because you want a complete record.
Right.
Because stuff you're dating might fall, you know, in that they need everything to fall in that range.
Right. And so this has been extremely helpful for radiocarbon dating because they have managed to compile basically a library of tree ring data.
Mm-hmm.
Going back like 14,500 years.
It's amazing.
It's called the Holocene Tree Record. And it's one of the, I didn't even know it existed. Now I love it.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
I want a bound copy of it just right. for the coffee table or something, you know?
And lay in a hammock in the middle of Pando.
And read it.
And read it.
And be like, oh, look meta. At this year, Pando. What do you think? What happened this year?
And Pando would hug you.
Yeah.
So I was trying to think of something you would do back to Pando, but
I would go blow on Pando's leaves.
I bet that feels good.
Sure.
So there are other places in nature that have these same kind of snapshots. If you wanted more than, because we need more just than the Holocene tree record, they can use coral reef because there's clearly carbon in the ocean.
Yeah.
Stalactites and stalagmites, which are called speleothems. If anyone ever busts that out at a party, you'll know what they're talking about.
Just back away slowly.
Yeah, you probably should. Because everyone else is just going to be talking about, I can never remember which ones are
exactly.
which.
Exactly. Oh, you mean speleothems?
Yeah, just
let me educate you.
Goodbye. They are made of carbon, and they are deposited in layers, just like the tree rings and the coral. In fact, they have found some in China kind of recently that go back 54,000 years.
Yeah, I think they really recently found this, so much so that it hasn't been like fully vetted, but they were super excited about it, that the idea that it gave a basically a long mineral-rich tree ring library of 54,000 years of the carbon-14 concentrations in the atmosphere.
That's awesome.
That, and, if it does pan out, that would be amazing.
And what's the deal that with the lake in Japan? It reliably puts down a new layer of sediment every 6 months. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, and so they've taken core samples, and in these core samples, they've turned up like leaves trapped in single layers in something like 650 different spots. So all they have to do is count backwards, find, you know, the, and they'll know the year that this leaf is trapped in.
It's like the tree rings.
And then test the carbon 14 in the leaf, and you've got like a picture right there.
And that is called what we'll call a library of atmospheric carbon 14 concentrations.
Yeah. The
it
whole,
should have a name.
It does. It's called INTCAL.
Okay.
INTCAL. And there's different programs that you can run all this through. Like before, back in the 40s and 50s, they were, I guess, using slide rules and stuff like this to come up with these. Now we have basically machine learning algorithms running these these computations for us. But they have programs that use this calibration library to basically say, here's the what the radiocarbon date is saying. What does this library of absolute dates say?
Yeah.
And then what they do is they actually, well, the computer, I should say, overlaps what's called the wiggles.
And they hold it up to the light.
Yeah. And they find like where these kind of wiggles overlap, which are confidence intervals, I guess.
Yeah.
And where it's most confident that you have a pretty good idea of what the range is for the age of this sample.
And that means we know exactly how old everything is always, right?
I mean, precisely, to the day.
That is not true.
No.
Because all the things we just mentioned, the speleothems, the coral, everything has its own individual problems.
Right.
Coral, it turns out, isn't a great material for calibrating this stuff because ocean concentrations of carbon are not the same as in the atmosphere.
Right.
So that kind of throws it off right there.
It does. So if you're comparing like something that lived on land to coral in the library, in the INTCAL library, it's not going to calibrate very well. Tree rings are a problem too because they figured out that depending on the hemisphere that the tree grew in, it will give you a different atmospheric concentration. Because the southern atmosphere has more oceans, and those oceans absorb more carbon dioxide. So there's actually less carbon-14 on land in the southern hemisphere than there is in the northern hemisphere. So if you checked out a waterlogged oak that grew in Ireland in 1082 CE, if you found a coyote tree.
What?
A coyote tree in New Zealand that grew that same year, they would have different radiocarbon dates.
Right.
Because they have different carbon radiocarbon concentrations. So it's just, there's a lot of things confounding this stuff that's keeping it from being less precise.
That's right. And it gets even worse because there have been long stretches of time on Earth in our history where carbon-14 production really increased every year over, you know, hundreds of thousands of years or tens of thousands.
Yeah, well, there's stretches. So all over the radiocarbon calendar, there are these things called plateaus. And I think the longest that they've ever found is a few hundred years.
When I said tens of thousands.
Yeah, it was a little off. Just like a radiocarbon date.
All right. I don't feel so bad.
They found this thing called the Hallstatt Plateau.
More like the Hallstatt disaster.
Yeah, that's what some people call it.
Am I right?
I'm sure that's what Willard Libby called it.
Sure.
But basically, there were periods during Earth's history. This one in particular goes from 760 to 420 BCE, where the production of carbon-14 in the atmosphere just increased basically steadily every year.
Mm-hmm.
So nothing ever got older relative to new stuff.
Right.
Which means that if you radiocarbon date something at in 760 BCE and something in 420 BCE, they're going to give you the same exact radiocarbon date.
420, huh?
Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
420. That was your response? 420, huh?
Hey, there's people out there thinking it.
To the Hallstatt disaster.
Uh-huh.
All right. Willard Libby would be proud.
He was the wild man.
Yep.
So this is why all this is important. It's not just to put a date on something so we know how old it is,
mm-hmm.
and we can just put it down in a museum or a history book or whatever.
Right.
It really opens up all of science and all of ancient history to interpretation and kind of rocked the world about a lot of things that we thought were true that aren't true.
Yeah, they call it the radiocarbon revolution, and like for good reason, really, yeah.
Well, one good example is in the UK there, we've talked about Stonehenge.
Mm-hmm.
They used to think that Stonehenge was the result of the, how do you pronounce that?
Mycenae? I don't know.
Mycenae?
You'd think I'd know. Mycenae.
I think it's the Mycenae civilization in Greece.
But the A and the E on the end, it's got to do something more than, like, why not just add a Y instead of an E?
Hey, I'm with you.
And, you know, sometimes you see the A and the E together conjoined.
Sure.
Like Ronnie and Donnie Galleon.
Right.
You know?
Wow.
So what is that?
I don't know.
It's its own thing.
So we used to think that it came from an ancient Greek civilization, but because of radiocarbon dating, they said, no. This is, we had the age all wrong,
mm-hmm.
and Stonehenge came before that ever happened, before the civilization was even there.
Right.
So it really helps clear up a picture of everything from Ötzi the Iceman to knowing that the Shroud of Turin was only 700 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So it can confirm things. And it can quash other things.
Right. And then and the way that they used to do it before was they would just kind of dig in the earth and turn up artifacts. And because an artifact was closer to the ground than another one, it just meant it was more recent. That's like as precise as they could get. Radiocarbon was like, not only are we going to do away with that, but get this, pal. Here's a date and a pretty good estimate of a date that this thing existed. That's how much it changed things. They used to be like, this is older than this. Now it's this Ötzi the Iceman was running around, you know, in 3300 BCE.
Right.
And in doing that, it also changes everything in that they're saying, oh, well, Ötzi was also found with tattoos on him that seemed to suggest acupuncture, which apparently they didn't think anymore. But that changed our idea of how old acupuncture was.
Right.
And then he had certain tools on him. We didn't know that they were making these tools back then. But now that we've reliably dated Ötzi,
mm-hmm.
we know that this tool-making complex is much older. People had professions much sooner than we thought.
Yes.
It just opens up everything when you have a date for one thing.
Yeah, the tendrils are far-reaching.
Right, exactly.
And broad.
And it happened actually here in the United States, too, or in North America. You know, we did a whole episode on the Clovis police.
Remember that? Sure, the Clovis.
The idea that the Clovis people were the first Americans,
mm-hmm.
and they came over from crossing over the, I guess, the Bering Land Bridge when the ice sheet receded. And so Willard Libby did a test that showed there was no way that the ice sheet was open anywhere before 12,000 to 15,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So he actually set a baseline. This is when the earliest people possibly could have been here. Well, we've been finding and radiocarbon dating settlements that are older than that. They found one in Idaho on the Snake River. I can't remember the name of the island. That's like almost 16,000 years old. And it shows definitively that Since the ice sheet was there, they couldn't have come over on the Bering Land Bridge, so now we think the first Americans came over by boat.
That's right.
All because of radiocarbon dating.
Amazing. But we're screwing it all up yeah. for the future because of human activity. That, you know, we're burning a lot of fossil fuels and we are releasing a lot of carbon into the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. And so much so that that consistent, previously reliable ratio of carbon 12 to carbon 14 has been knocked all out of whack because right. of us. And in the next, what?
30 years?
Yeah, 30 to 40 years. We may not be able to date things accurately using this method anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. Because when they say, well, you burn fossil fuels, you release a lot of carbon dioxide. Well, those fuels used to be alive. So they used to have carbon 14 in them, but they're so old, there isn't any carbon 14. Now it's all just carbon 12. And we're releasing tons of carbon 12 into the atmosphere that wouldn't normally be there.
That's right. And, nuclear tests that we conducted, had the opposite effect. Between 1955 and 1963, the concentration of carbon-14 in the atmosphere doubled, almost doubled.
Yeah. So there's
so
a lot.
It's all screwy now.
It is very screwy, so much so that now they have modern samples. They have a beet harvest from the 70s that they used to replace a beet from France from 1950 that they used to be like, this is the baseline now for yeah. modern. This is what we're reduced to, is sampling beets for God's sake. That's how much it screwed things up.
I love beets.
But they have figured out how to use this kind of modern screwiness to also date recent remains, which everyone thought was just impossible, that you couldn't tell when a body lived or died if it were just a decade or so
right.
dead or less.
But we have historical records for all this stuff. I know it's a big deal, but like, mm-hmm. and we're screwing stuff up for the future, but... Isn't the utility of carbon-14 dating because it was pre-history?
Yeah, that certainly helps. And yeah, I guess you're right. The having a record would definitely help quite a bit.
And I'm not, saying like, who cares then?
Right.
But at least we have that going for us.
Yeah, that is a good point. It'd be like, well, the leather seat from this automobile is the same age as this leather shoe from 3,000 years before, which is which?
Right.
But yeah, they have figured out how to use it for forensics based on your teeth enamel, which are like tree rings, and then based on your soft tissues. But your soft tissues degrade, so they figured out that they can actually test the casings from the larvae that eat your soft tissues as you're decomposing.
So the soft tissue is the carbon-14 in this scenario?
Yeah, which you're constantly remaking. And then as you die, it stops being taken in and then starts decaying. And as you're being eaten by these, bug larvae,
yeah.
they shed their casings, and the casings don't degrade. So you can come along and test the casings, and they ate your carbon-14. And you can figure out when that body last lived based on the casings of the bugs that ate it.
And in a million years, if I were not to get cremated and they were to bury me into the ground, mm-hmm. the only thing that would remain of me are the three titanium screws holding in my three fake teeth.
That's neat. A million years. Who'd have thought?
Yep. There he is.
Yeah. There's Chuck. One, two, three. You got anything else?
There may be more than that by then, too.
You're right.
It might be four or five.
So anything else? You want to keep going? We can keep talking about this.
I have no dinner plans.
Okay. Well, I think we're going to stop with carbon-14. We don't want to press our luck. It did go pretty well, Chuck. I told you.
I think so.
And since I said it went pretty well, it's time for listener mail.
All right. I was preparing for the next episode.
Yeah, we got listener mail first.
Look at me. All right. I'm going to call this soup follow-up. If you remember, we talked about canned soup in a previous episode on what else? Augmented reality.
Right.
I think we were pegged as progresso guys because you spoke up first.
Yeah.
With a name brand.
Right.
I'm a Campbell's man.
I don't discriminate. I like Campbell's Chunky too.
I just kind of went along with it. I didn't want to ruffle any feathers.
Okay.
I didn't speak up. Mm-hmm. But this is about that. Hey guys, there are no words to describe how much I enjoy your podcast. I've listened to every single episode and continue to do so each and every week. Thank you for bringing wonderful science, exploration for knowledge, and laughs to my days.
So far, so good.
I listened to the latest episode on augmented reality while on a plane to Boston, and I could not stop laughing when you got to a full-on tangent about canned soup. I thought, this is my moment. This is my chance to ride in. I've been too starstruck before, but here we go. I know canned soup all too well. I spent 7 years right out of college working for General Mills. Yes, they make the cereal, but they also own Progresso. I worked in sales managing our businesses with our East Coast and national accounts. 3 years ago, I left General Mills and went to work for Campbell Soup.
Oh, it's like Adidas and Puma over here.
I guess so. Just outside of Philadelphia, I guess you could say I, too, have a thing for canned soup. I currently manage our soup and Prego business at one of our largest East Coast grocery chains. And although it doesn't seem complicated, I can tell you a lot of work goes into you enjoying your can of red and white chicken noodle soup. I still love that. Campbell's chicken noodle.
Oh, yeah.
So good.
It's like, how do you mess with a classic like that?
But
there's also Progresso creamy chicken noodle, which is the bomb.
When you mentioned this episode brought to you by Progresso as a joke, I was just waiting for you to plug that. You liked Campbell's as well, and even more. Ha ha. Either way, I'm just glad you both enjoy eating our soups. I would be happy to give you a tour of Campbell's Soup HQ if you're ever in Philly. Thanks to the entire team for all you do. You guys are a legend.
Combined into a singular.
That's from Kathleen. And Kathleen, no shade to Progresso, but I'm a Campbell's man. I eat three soups.
A day?
No. I eat Campbell's chicken noodle. Uh-huh. I eat chicken corn chowder.
I don't know if I've had that.
That's so good.
Is it?
And I eat their New England clam chowder.
Yeah, that's good. Who eats Manhattan clam chowder?
I don't know.
Or, I'm sorry, Manhattan clam chowder.
No one. Not even Manhattanites.
They're like, get this away. Give me the real stuff.
Yeah, give me that creamy goodness.
Do you ever have meatball alphabet?
No.
Oh, I don't know what were in those meatballs, but I grew up on them. And look at me now.
I know. That's all good. The soups I eat, though. It's weird. I have three soups.
Yeah. You don't do the chunky stuff? Campbell's chunky?
I mean,
they come in large cans. It's like a Hungry Man.
Well,
version
that's of, the chicken corn chowder and the.
I have had that and it's good.
Those are chunky.
Have you ever had the chicken pot pie?
No, but I just made a homemade gluten free chicken pot pie, biscuit topped.
Well, how do you make a biscuit without gluten?
You make it with 1-to-1 flour instead of wheat flour.
What kind of flour is not wheat flour?
What?
Is like the white flour, bleached flour.
Have you never
flour,
heard of gluten-free pasta? And
no. I mean, yes. I've heard of it. I haven't eaten it.
It's just made with flour without gluten. It's called 1-to-1, as in the ratio.
Oh, I see. I gotcha.
So basically, you buy the gluten-free flour. Sometimes right. It's rice flour.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Tapioca, but...
Have you had chickpea flour?
I don't think so.
It's not bad.
I mean, I'm not gluten-free. I did this so Emily could enjoy chicken pot pie.
Sure.
But, you know, you lay out, you make the little chicken the little biscuits.
Mm-hmm.
And you lay them on top of your pot pie.
Oh, that sounds nice.
And then you brush it with egg yolk.
Nice.
And then it bronzes up to a shiny brown top.
Like people laying on the beach in Rio.
So good.
That is nice, man.
Yeah, make a good chicken pot pie.
Have you had it already? But is it like at home?
Yeah, I had it this past weekend.
Nice.
But I have not had the soup, which is what led me to that tangent.
It's good. I don't discriminate. Progresso, Campbell's, it's all good.
All right.
Well, Chuck is checking his phone to see what time it is, so I guess we should probably end this episode. If you want to get in touch with us to offer us a tour of where you work, that's always nice. Thank you. You can go on to stuffyoushouldknow.com, check out our social links, or you can send us an email to stuffpodcasts@iheartradio.com.
Stuff You Should Know is a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Refinancing your car at Kemba Financial Credit Union can get you quick access to cash to help manage high-rate debts and expenses. Get up to $500 next day cash back, plus no payments for 90 days, and take cash equity out. Make your car work for you and drive away with extra cash. Apply at Kemba.org. Restrictions apply. Offer ends April 30th, 2024. Federally insured by NCUA.